And we are now recording to the cloud. So again, welcome all. And we have a fair number of slides to go through. So I'll kick it off right away to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Hey, thanks, Chris, and good evening, everyone. We'll get right into it because we do have quite a number of slides, as Chris says. First thing is a follow-up on computer magazines at the library, the electronic versions. And this is an email which I received about a week or so ago. And this is, I've been getting these emails telling me that PC Magazine and PC World are available for viewing. However, you notice this one has a big yellow flash which says that magazines are no longer available through RB Digital after March the 31st. And sure enough, I left things for a couple of days, and when I tried to open the magazine, the library is no longer subscribed to Zinio. And it says now that the magazines have moved to the Libby app. However, if you go to the main website and scroll down to digital magazines and then keep going to Overdrive magazines, you'll find this blue flash which says go to Overdrive magazines, which is formerly RB Digital and Zinio. And sure enough, if you do that, eventually you can open the current issue of PC Magazine. And it has an interesting series of articles on spring cleaning your computers and phones and everything else. And I combined all the various, the items of interest. One of the things they say is that you put a piece of paper on the desk so you can find it easily, and then you put another piece of paper on top of that so you can find it. And before you know it, your desk is covered in paper and you can't find anything. So they were suggesting to use a scanner and digitize everything so you can basically search for your documents electronically. Use containers for things like flash drives. Label chargers and cables is a good idea. I'm sure everybody has a number of different chargers, and they're not necessarily all interchangeable. So it might not be a bad idea to put a sticky label on and write the instructions there. And take away icons that you don't use on the desktop or the home screen of your phone. Just tidying things up, basically. Clear the inbox. If you've got 10,000 emails in your inbox, it might not be a bad idea to stick some of them into local folders and tidy things up a bit. Archive photos that you've taken on the phone to the PC or to an external USB drive. Basically, free up some storage space. And remove any apps that you don't use. Everybody installs apps to try them out, but then we're reluctant to delete them, I guess, once we find them they're not very useful. And for those of you that use a million browser tabs, maybe you could close a few of them and make your life a bit simpler. The one thing I did do a while ago was to try and find a home for all these different little flash drives that I have hanging around with backups of files and bootable copies of Linux and Windows 10 and all that kind of stuff. And I like this thing. It says you keep tins and decorative boxes because you think they'll be useful someday. Today's the day. So today's the day you should find your boxes and make them useful for something. So if you want to check the website, the library's website, and look at the e-magazines, you'll find the full details in the article in PC Magazine. Okay, this is a question that came in that Chris has the answer to.
Yeah, this was, I found this rather a fascinating issue. And so Natalie, who's on the call tonight, feel free to jump in, Natalie, if I misrepresent anything. But Natalie was using Kaspersky's utility for vulnerability scanning. And it detected that 7-zip on her computer had security vulnerabilities. So she updated to the latest 7-zip, and Kaspersky was still complaining about vulnerabilities in 7-zip. And it turned out that the problem was in files that were in program files x86, NSIS uninstall information, and then a GUID, so a globally unique ID number that a lot of programs use just to make sure that they don't conflict with anything else. And so she wanted to know, what is this NSIS? And there are other folders in that folder, within that folder, with files in them. And she wondered whether she should be concerned about that or not. So I did a little bit of research on it. And next slide, Alan.
Sorry.
And I looked up NSIS, and it turns out it's NullSoft Scriptable Install System, which is an open source program that is used to create installers under Windows. So there are a number of programs out there that can do create installation packages when you create a program, and it'll put the files in the right places, make registry changes, and so forth. So the URL is there. It's of no real consequence, but if anybody is interested in a free and open source install system for Windows, you could go there and check it out. Now, don't remove everything that you find underneath that program files x86 NSIS uninstall information unless you know what it's for, because it will almost certainly remove the ability to uninstall that particular program that is associated with that. So I say here the title is 7-Zip, really, because it was identified as being the problem area, and you see that GUID, the OpenBrace 32C8 and so forth. I did a Google on that, and it comes up pointing to the fact that it belongs to CyberLink PowerDVD 14 rather than 7-Zip, which, I mean, in theory, you know, it could actually, a GUID could have been assigned, I suppose, to two separate programs, but it's extremely unlikely. So I'm not sure why Kaspersky was pointing to that particular folder of information and saying that it belonged to 7-Zip, because almost certainly it belongs to CyberLink PowerDVD 14. And I would suspect that by removing the files, that folder, and all the files underneath it, that you probably can no longer uninstall PowerDVD. Now, also curious is that Kaspersky was then happy that it was not identifying a vulnerability in 7-Zip. I don't know if it turned out that really 7-Zip was actually finding a vulnerability in PowerDVD and was blaming it on 7-Zip or what. I really don't know at this point, you know, exactly what was going on. But I suspect that the ability to uninstall PowerDVD 14 has gone away on that computer. Now, if you run into that sort of problem, one of the ways that you can end up uninstalling that program is if you can reinstall it, then it will get the uninstall folder back, and then you would be able to do a proper uninstall of it. So what would I do in a situation, something like that? So the first thing is to try to positively identify the program that is in those folders that are underneath that NSIS uninstall information folder. So you can Google for it. So in this case here, you see the 32C8E300 folder name that I actually Googled for that, and that's where I came up with this pointer towards CyberLink PowerDVD 14. So that, to me, sort of indicated that, yes, this is what that folder is all about. The other thing you could do is search the registry. Now, I don't have that particular folder on my computer, so here is I just, you know, randomly went into my registry, and I looked under HK Local Machine Software, Microsoft Windows Current Version, uninstall, and basically you end up with those folder names there, those GUIDs that are for each of the programs. And so in this case, I just selected one of them, and over on the right-hand side, I can see that that particular GUID is associated with LibreOffice 7.1. You know, so that's another way that I could sort of identify where or what that folder is actually associated with. And although that location is typically where you will find it, you could just search for you know, open brace 14E9, DACB, and so forth, that entire string there, and then just have it, you know, go through the registry and find it. Eventually, you'll end up with some stuff where it does identify the program. So that may help you to identify what a particular folder in an uninstall situation is actually pointing to.
Tom's asking, what does GUID stand for?
Globally Unique ID. So it's a globally unique identifier, and it's an algorithm. I think Microsoft actually developed it. It was basically that anybody who wants something that will be guaranteed, or as much as you can guarantee, unique name worldwide, you know, you can run this algorithm, and it will come up with one of these, I think it's a 32-bit number or something like that, and you can then just run with that and assume that that will not be used by anybody else. So rather than using a folder name of my text editor, you know, which somebody else might come up with a text editor and call it my text editor. So if you use these GUIDs instead, you're guaranteed to not have conflicts with something else. So globally unique identifier. Okay, another thing that you could do is if you go into a particular folder like this and you find any executable or DLL, you could right-click on it and choose Properties in the Details tab. And then usually you will get some information on the Details tab here. I right-clicked on Pixillion Setup v6.10.exe, and I can see that this belongs to NCH software, and the file description says Pixillion image converter. So that might help you to identify where, you know, who these files belong to. And then what do you do about it? Well, if you can positively identify the program and you decide that, yes, this is something that I want to get rid of, you could rename or move the folder to another location. I make a note here that not a bad idea to note the original location, so that if something bad happens on your computer, you can move it back. And then leave it there for a period of time, you know, a month, a year, I don't know, whatever you feel comfortable with, and then just delete the files if, you know, everything seems to be working as you expect it to. So that's, in this case of that 7-zip, that's probably what I would have done, is gone in and seen if that folder was positively identified as being 7-zip files, and, you know, just installing the latest version didn't get rid of those files. Well, just get rid of them off the system so that they're not cluttering things up. I would probably do that. Just, you know, take that entire folder, you know, the brace 32, CAD 300 and so forth. Take that entire folder, move it elsewhere for a period of time. And then after a while, if everything seems to be working fine, delete it. So that's the approach that I would take on something like that. If anybody else has some other ideas about, you know, what to do in a situation like that, by all means, pipe in.
Chris, it's Natalie here.
Yeah.
Okay, so there were other files that I did not know what they were, but there were actually some that had CyberLink named on them, so that makes sense.
Okay.
But now that I've gotten rid of those two that had zip 7 on them, can I reinstall the PowerDVD?
Well, PowerDVD is still installed. The files that were in that location are used to uninstall the program.
Okay.
So as long as you don't care about uninstalling, then everything will continue to function fine. If you ever decide that you want to uninstall CyberLink, the only way you're going to be able to uninstall it is to reinstall it, and you probably would have to get, you know, the exact same version of the program, reinstall it, and then you would be able to uninstall it. But if you're not looking to uninstall it, everything should continue to function fine.
Okay, yeah, no, that wasn't the problem. It was the 7-zip that was.
Yeah, I know. I think that Kaspersky just got confused, and it was blaming files in that location as being, you know, vulnerable. I don't know. It seems really, really bizarre. Things are not matching up the way that I would expect them to match up. But Kaspersky's happy now, so that's fine. And as long as you don't need to uninstall PowerDVD, you should be fine, good to go.
Okay, yeah, and I think I'm going to avoid reinstalling 7-Zip.
Well, I don't know. I suspect that Kaspersky getting confused over 7-Zip is probably a one-off, reinstalling it. If you like 7-Zip, I don't think there's necessarily any reason to avoid 7-Zip. But, you know, that's your call. I don't personally find a real use for separate zipping programs. Windows itself can handle zipping. And I do use a program which has zipping capabilities built into it as well. So I tend not to go to those third-party apps to just handle zips. But, yeah, that's up to you whether you find value in it or not.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for doing the research. Much appreciated.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was really interesting. Okay.
Tom, I think, is saying 7-Zip compresses smaller.
Oh, could be, yeah. And Lawrence says
sometimes an error is just an alert, which may or may not be harmful. Of course, many times you don't know until time goes by.
Yeah, that's true.
What I did was they had a notice on their website, so it led me to the Kaspersky website, and it was actually some critical vulnerability, which is why I was concerned about it. So, yeah, it wasn't just an alert, I think.
That doesn't sound like an alert.
yeah, it sounds more serious than that. But I presume that that directory name that you got was within Kaspersky. It gave you the ability to see exactly where the vulnerable files were?
Right.
Yeah. So in that case, I would not be really worried at all, because the files in that location, the only time they are going to run is if you uninstall the program. That's all those files are there for, is to do uninstalls. So, you know, in the normal day-to-day course of actions, you know, those files are never going to be run. So even if Kaspersky identifies vulnerabilities, it's really of no consequence.
Okay, so the key is know what it's for and if you...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Got it. Lesson learned.
Yep. Okay. It was fun. Thanks for bringing that up.
Okay. You've seen this slide before, asking for smart apps, useful applications for Android, and also for programs for the PC. And this week, Stuart has sent in one that he's trying. Explore File Manager is he says he's had it on his wish list for a long time. He's recently installed it because he's seen a lot of good recommendations. It's an Android file manager. Far beyond my understanding of Android, inspired me to try and learn more. Well, it turns out I've actually been using this program too, and I don't really know all that much about it. But it is available from the Play Store. And the main feature is, if you have a wide screen, it, like a tablet, it gives you a dual pane, a tree view of your disk. So if you have let's say a smartphone, you'll see the internal storage on one side. And if you have a micro SD card, then you'll see that on the other side. And then you can basically copy files between them. One of the neat features, it has a disk map, which will show you kind of graphically which folders and which files are using the most space on the device, which can be really useful, as I found out when there was a problem with one of the applications. It will also deal with cloud storage like Google Drive and Dropbox and several others. And it has built-in viewers for PDF files and images and that sort of thing. And it's highly configurable. And in terms of, you know, being difficult to use, I told Stuart that I thought it was a question of learning by doing, because generally with apps, you don't get a user manual. But eagle-eyed Chris noticed on Google Play Store that there is actually a link to a user manual. And the user manual is actually quite good. It has pretty graphics and descriptions of how to do various things, like, as I say, copying files from one side of the thing to the other. And it's fairly user-friendly, even on a phone where you've got a small screen, so you really only see one disk at once. But you can see here that the phone's internal memory is highlighted. The micro SD card is there. And just note that the micro SD card is OC27 something on this phone. And there's also a root area down here, which I actually use this program because when I download updates to my custom ROM, by default, and in fact, I don't think I can change it, and they store the updates in the root area of the phone. The problem is the updates are 400 megabytes plus, so if I just kept downloading updates every week or every month, I'd soon run out of space if I didn't move those files away from the root area and onto the micro SD card, which has got lots and lots of space. However, if you look on the regular storage, the emulated zero is the internal storage of the phone, and I've got a camera folder here. If I open the camera folder, you can see I've got a whole bunch of JPEG images, and there's some useful buttons here. On the right, there's a button to allow me to copy things, and at the top here, there's this kind of two-panel icon, which basically switches between the left panel and the right panel, the two drives. So here I've selected all of the images on the phone storage, and now I can go over to the micro SD card here and go down to screenshots. You'll see there's nothing there. But if I choose to copy these files, four files, and I click on this button to move them rather than copy them and say OK, then it copies them over. So now you can see that this is the micro SD card, and I've moved all the images over into something called screenshots. Now what I've done is I've tagged two of the images here, which are pictures of my monitors. I've tagged them, and I'm going to hit the delete key to make them go away. And once I do that, I can say OK, and I'll be left with the other two images. So it's actually quite easy to use once you have played around with it a little bit, and it's quite effective. So it's quite a nice program for an Android device, tablet or a smartphone. Okay, here's another share from Chris.
Yeah, I said that we do, in the past I've said that we take things up in the order that they're received, but this just came out today, and it was kind of fun. The Windows Insider program at Microsoft, they had a bit of a competition with polling on Twitter, and they were looking for the most popular key combination in Windows, most of which were Windows itself, but some of them were for some Microsoft programs such as Word. And so, like March Madness, they started out with 64 key combos, and they asked people to vote on pairs of them until they whittled it down to today. The final vote result, it was against Control-C versus Alt-Tab, and the winner was Control-C. And the link you see there will bring you to the picture of that you're seeing here, which is the entire bracket. And one of the things I found kind of neat about this was as we went through the votings, some of them I totally didn't know or had forgotten about particular keystrokes that would do things. And I thought, yeah, I could, if I remember that, you know, maybe I'll use that sometimes, you know, like what does win and D do, or, you know, what's win control shift B. And, you know, I think that one reloads the video driver and things like that. So it was kind of cool going through and seeing some of these keystrokes that I haven't used ever or in a long time. So I'm trying to come up with, I thought that they might put up a list somewhere of each of those key combos and what they actually do. And if I find something like that, I'll post it or bring it up at a future Q&A if people are interested.
There are lots of lists like that, but one of the most sort of easy to access lists is if you have Power Toys installed, if you hold down the Windows key, it will actually show you the keys that go along with Windows key to do a variety of things. Like,
yeah, it gives you about 20 or so of the keystrokes that are available. So, yeah, that's very, very useful for sure. But, yeah, it's nowhere near comprehensive. And I would like it if this specific list, because they had this bracket, if they would come out with a complete list of that. I've seen various lists of, combination keystrokes, but I just thought it'd be cool if they came out with one list for this bracket.
I like Control-Alt-Delete.
Yeah.
Although it's less effective these days.
Well, it's good for changing passwords.
And opening the test manager.
Yeah.
Control-S will do that.
Okay, moving on from shortcuts, I have a question about LibreOffice Writer. And this is one of my maintenance files where I keep track of updates to my system. And I've been using this thing for several years, and it's quite long. It's 110 pages of text. And normally, when I open the file, the cursor jumps right to the end of the file because that's the last entry, and that's where it wants me to start. But just recently, this particular file has been going to page 89, and I've got no idea why. Has anybody seen this kind of behavior before, and how do I fix it? There's no obvious, control characters in those in the vicinity of that line. But when the program goes wrong and it does this, it always goes to the 2nd of October 2019. It's really bizarre. And it's also the only file in my whole system it seems to do this with. All the others open normally.
Even if they
one opens normally some of the time.
Even if they have more than 89 pages?
Yeah, I've got several which are quite a number of pages.
I think what I would do is probably try copying and pasting into a new document and then see if the new document works correctly.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, because the whole idea of the open document format is it's actually a zip file that contains all kinds of stuff beneath it. And I wouldn't be surprised if one of those files that's within that zip file, if you just rename it to a zip, you can open it with a zip file manager. And I bet you one of the files in that XML collection of files is a file that says what the last save, the cursor position when you last saved it. And I bet you that file is not getting updated correctly or something like that. So, yeah.
I'll certainly try that. Sounds like a good option anyway.
If it carries the problem forward, that's really bizarre.
Yeah, especially if I do a copy text. Right?
Yeah. Anybody else got ideas on that?
I don't see anything on the chat.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a question came in this afternoon for all you French-speaking people out there. This is Greg. At work, he has the enterprise version of Windows 10 and Excel, which are in French, and he'd like to have Excel working in English, especially the functions. And if the whole interface was in English, that would be even better. So how does he get the English version of Excel? And I wondered whether it was just a question of changing the language, because Office will let you change the language that you use for editing, for proofing, for reviewing the text, or the spreadsheet, the PowerPoint slides, whatever. And also the display language for things like buttons and menus. So I don't know whether that's sufficient for what Greg needs. I suggested that to him. I haven't heard back. Is there anybody else using bilingual versions of Office that knows any better than that. If you do, put something in the chat window and we'll follow up with it later on.
I wish I had a better idea on what how the regional settings work within Windows, but what I believe to have discovered is that Windows 10 regional settings, even though you have these options here within the program itself, they do not change the menu options that are driven from the selection on the Windows 10 side of the regional settings.
Well, I know there are localized versions of Office that is meant to be the entire user interface of it in a different language. And then basically on top of that, you can just do, you know, your dictionaries and some things like that. But outside of that, I don't know, yeah, in terms of trying to get the user interface to change. I'm not sure.
And this page here actually has specific instructions for recent versions of Office and also for older versions of Office. So the language settings are specific to Office, not specific to Windows.
Yeah. And the display language is for all buttons, menus, and controls in Office.
Correct.
That would seem to contradict my impressions, but maybe it's because I haven't dug that deep. So, I mean, it would be interesting. Who's the gentleman that asked this question?
His name's Greg, and he's an employee of the provincial Quebec government, I believe.
Yeah.
We don't have a Greg on the call
tonight.
I don't think
he's on the call. I didn't see the name earlier.
Yeah it would be interesting if he could go in.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. You are. There he is.
It would be interesting to try that display language.
Go ahead, Greg.
So what I've noticed through the Excel, one which has to do with the proofing, proofread your text and so on. And then there are other aspects which has to do with navigation, it's the function, because they're quite lengthy in French, instead of H lookup, it's recherche V, and it's very hard to learn as well. And they seem to be driven by the Office, and yes, as Chris mentioned, I did see there's something for local language or regional. The only thing maybe which was peculiar with my employer is that the it's Windows 10 and it's Excel 2013, but when I click to add the package, it's going to Office 365. I wonder if it has to do with the fact that it's Excel 2013. So.
Yeah, kind of hard to say. I know that Microsoft certainly has changed their the way that they deal with the user interface portions of Office over the years. And I know back from when I worked at NRCan, we actually installed, you know, French version of Office or English version of Office on people's computer. We didn't do a multi-language version that allowed people to switch back and forth. And I was not part of the team that did the desktop builds, but my understanding was that they said things didn't work properly. So they found it much better to install either English Office or French Office. But I don't know the details on that. And that does date back some too. So that would probably be going back to, well, at least a few versions of Office, but I don't really know the details on that.
And Tom has just posted another link in chat to one of the answers.microsoft.com postings. So you might want to check that, see if it's any of any use.
Yeah, I'll check that. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, Gail made a mention as well. She said, not be surprised if you do not need a different license. And I think that that was a case that you could install a particular localized version, or you could install the multi-language one, or there were definitely some licensing implications. Again, this goes back a little bit, so it may be different now, but I really don't know.
So there's a question from Natalie about a Samsung smartphone, deleting pictures, and one of the options is move to trash, but she can't find the trash folder. Is there a second step, or are the files actually deleted rather than being moved to a trash folder? Certainly on my phone's a Motorola, and there is a trash folder. And if you use that Explore file manager, you'll probably be able to find it. But I don't know about Samsung.
On the Samsung phones, I'm running version 8 of Android on my phone. Unfortunately, they've given up on that phone, so I won't get anything newer. But there is a maintenance section within the phone where you can say clean up this phone. And one of the things was when you do run maintenance on it, it will get rid of files periodically. And I don't know what it's getting rid of, because it just says, you know, deleting files. And it just says, you know, oh, we cleaned up, you know, 250K of files. So I would maybe hazard a guess that this is something to do with its trash. I don't know. And Natalie, if you look on your phone to look for a maintenance section within settings, you could try running that, and that might clean up a whole bunch of space.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I'm always hesitant to do sort of a massive thing that lets the device do its thing, because I don't know what it's doing.
Yeah, I often wonder what it's doing, but I've never had anything go missing that, you know, I specifically put something somewhere. So I really suspect that it's temporary files or a trash or something like that that it's cleaning up. But I'm just guessing. As Alan has pointed out on numerous occasions, the file system on Android is really bizarre.
Yeah, I'm sometimes very confused. So I might try that Explore, whatever it's called. Yeah.
Yeah, the maintenance. If you can't find it, flip me an email, and I'll tell you where I found it on my version of Android anyways.
Thanks. Yeah, even the storage, you know, it's very confusing what's where and what it belongs to. It's very confusing.
Yeah.
Bill's asking whether it's possible to delete the delete folder instead of deleting the messages.
No, I've never deleted any folders. I've just deleted files, like pictures. That's it. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know if I deleted them. Maybe if they moved somewhere and they're still there using up space. I don't know.
Okay, well, we'll move along. Our next section is all about scams and frauds. And remember, we were asking you for examples. But before we get into the examples that we have on tap, I just remind you to think about the ones that you've seen recently, if you see anything different than you see here tonight, and just tell us all about them. But before we do that, Chris has got some thoughts.
Yeah, I just looked at some things in my spam folder and just looked at how I would identify things as being spam or scam or good. And so here's one from DHL, supposedly. And if I look at the from line, it says DHL Express, and then the actual email address is chris.taylor@ctpost.com. Well, I kind of doubt that, you know, my name would be associated with a legitimate person at the from, so that's really suspicious. If I hover over that button for follow my package, it goes to WeCare Credit, the helpers, or credithelpers.com. So it doesn't seem to be related to DHL at all. So I figure it's probably a scam. It's probably not spam, because it's not, they're not trying to sell me anything, so it's probably a scam. On this one here from Dyson, supposedly, if I look at the from, you know, it's at a googlemail.com domain name. So what's the likelihood that Dyson would actually be using a googlemail.com domain? Probably not really likely. If I hover the mouse over the link, it gives you a really, really long URL. And the way to really look at URLs is start at the left and go forward until you hit the first forward slash. Just before that is the domain name. So in this case, it's duckdns.org is the domain name that that link will actually go to. And I figure all of those characters in front of it are really there to obfuscate where you're going to be taken to. If people start looking at it, they see all these other characters before they actually see the real domain name. Now, at the bottom of that email, it actually, they don't pretend to actually be Dyson. So they actually come forward and they say, you know, this offer is organized independently. You know, and portal leads, you know, something like that. So it's as if it's a third party company that is trying to do something about Dyson or Dyson owners or something like that. And I figure that probably is a spam rather than a scam. It could be a scam as well, but probably they're going to try and sell you a Dyson vacuum cleaner or something like that, and you're not buying it from Dyson. You know, so I figure that's probably actually a spam. Next one I had was a plain text email. And one of the things that always flags me as being suspicious is when the from and the reply to are two different addresses. And I figure the reason why some people might do that is they'll get a mail from Michael Williams, you know, rin@comcast.net, and if they complain, maybe that email will get shut down. Well, if the scammer or spammer has been sending out millions of emails, they may still work if the reply to is something different that doesn't get shut down as quickly. So I suspect that that's why a lot of people use different reply tos from the from. There's no personalization in here at all. You know, good day to you, you know, they all that sort of thing. And there's no links in it. So it's not as if you're going to get taken to a site that is going to compromise your computer immediately. The only way to communicate back with this person is by replying to the email. And the reply to is going to go to a different address from the from. I suspect that this is probably just a scam or a spam, that they're going to try and sell you services, in this case a loan. It could possibly be a scam as well. But I suspect in this case, it's probably just a spammer who's trying to drum up business, you know, for his loan service.
I disagree. I think most of those loans, they say, oh, yeah, we can do it. Yeah, we can give you all kinds of credit. And no, you don't have to, you know, send us your account receivables information or anything like that. No. All you have to do is, well, there's a processing fee of, you know, $237.50. And you send that to us and we send you $10,000.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. Yeah. I mean, I can't tell 100% sure. Whether it's just a spam or just a scam or a scam. But regardless, I don't deal with spammers at all. And I hopefully will never deal with a scammer. So if it's either spam or scam, I just don't want to have anything to do with it. So to me, it's not a huge deal whether it's one or the other. You're probably right. It's probably more likely to be a scam than anything else. But I highly encourage people not to ever deal with spammers. If you buy things from spammers, even if they're a legitimate organization and you get your goods and things like that, all you're doing is encouraging further spam. So this one here, I thought it was interesting in that the top-level domain on the from address was .id, was Indonesia. So this person is coming up from there. Very, you know, it's a clickbait type email where, you know, they just want people to click on this, and it's yo dear, so not personalized. They've used Bitly to obscure the destination that you're going to go to, and they're just trying to entice people to click on it. So it could be a spam, it could be a scam. Definitely not something that I want to look at it all. It could be taking you to a site that, you know, they have all kinds of advertising that every click that goes on there, they get paid for, you know, ads that get read or things like that. Or it could be trying to part you with your money. I don't know. This one here, you know, was addressed to friend and then chris.taylor@opcug.ca. That's a bit of a flag that if they know my email address, why don't they know who I am? If you hover the mouse over the link, it actually looks like it's legit. So it's going to odi-x.com/firewall, and the product, the main part of the page is talking about a firewall product. And, you know, they do identify themselves in there as Odix Firewall security app. So I suspect that this is probably just spam, that they're trying to get you to buy a firewall product. And so, again, I don't deal with spammers, so I would not react to this at all. Okay, we saw earlier on that there was a bit.ly redirection, and there are a ton of URL redirections. And if you want to decode these so that you know where it's going to take you before you go there, for bit.ly, if you right-click on the bit.ly link and you copy the link location or get it onto your clipboard somehow, and then you go and paste it into the URL bar in your browser and add a plus at the end of it all, that will actually take you to bit.ly.com, and it will tell you where that link will actually take you if you go to it without the plus on it. So it's a way to decode those shortened URLs. The next one is decoding tiny URL redirection, and for that, you basically get the URL copied onto the clipboard again, and in this case here, I just went to the OPCUG website. I right-clicked on the link that comes to our meetings, and I copy the link address, paste it in, and then you go to the start of the URL, and you add preview dot. So rather than tinyurl/opcug-meeting, you go to preview.tinyurl.com/opcug-meeting, and it'll take you to the tiny URL site where it'll tell you the eventual location or the destination of that particular link. Now, after I found those two, I knew the tiny URL one for a long time, and I found the bit.ly one recently, but I just found this one, which is checkshorturl.com, and you can go there, and they say they will take care of hundreds of URL shortening services, like this one here, where bit.ly MSF023, and if you click on the expand, you end up getting more information, including the long URL, and then a little bit more information about the page. And Alan, this was a URL you came up with, right?
Yeah, that was one I had a couple of weeks ago on my wife's smartphone, and I thought it was a spam or scam rather, because this is Médecins Sans Frontières, you know, Doctors Without Borders, sending a bit.ly link in an SMS text message, which I thought was outrageous.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, it is a legitimate link, but it's not good practice in my opinion.
It may not fit in SMS. It's quite a long URL, and even though they've lengthened SMSs now, it's still long.
Well, then they should shorten their web page name.
Yeah.
Don't send me bit.ly links in SMS text messages.
But one of the reasons,
especially
they have,
when they didn't say who it was from, it didn't say like Médecins Sans Frontières. It just said, you know, click this link for information, sort of thing.
But one of the reasons they have long URLs is so it shows up well in the search engines.
Yeah, but they could have put more into the text message indicating what they were all about. I think that's the main complaint you had, Alan. It was that they had no information about what it was all about.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So okay. There's a comment in the chat from Andrew saying the browser in Windows Sandbox is useful for testing websites you're not sure of. I think the problem with that for me is that isn't that only available in like Windows Pro? There's no Sandbox in Windows.
Yeah, that's
Pro,
true. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Pro or Education or Enterprise.
So if you have Windows Pro, that's certainly an option for you. And Corrine found the trash in Samsung. It's under My Files. Click Options on the top right, and there is the trash file. And Natalie has found it, so everybody's happy.
Oh, cool.
And Chris now knows where it is too. At least yeah. When he reads the chat window.
Yeah.
There are also some add-ons to the various browsers. And the one I think that I'm using, I'm not quite sure. I think it's called Link Cleaner in Firefox. And basically, before there's a redirect to any different URL, any different domain, I guess, then it will come up and it will tell you that there's a redirect here, and then you have a choice of allowing it or not.
That's cool.
Okay, so now we've got some examples of scams that people have sent in ahead of time. And I think we've probably all seen this one. How are you? I need a little favor. Like, you know, drive your pickup truck down to Walmart and buy every Tim Hortons gift card they have and stick them in a Purolator box and send them to me. And I'll pay you back, certainly. So we've all seen that one. And the other one is this one. This is a Nigerian prince scam, or a variant of it. And he's the son of some rebel leader who got executed, but he's got tons of money he's willing to share. And 35% of, $18 million can be yours. 35%. Pretty good. But if that's not good enough, then choose from the above. Tom must have a spam on his email, because all these came from his email, and he got all of these and some more, which I took out because they were very similar, within 2 days. So I'm sure he's got a spam magnet there. So you could go with this guy who's willing to share $1 million with you. If you're going to use anybody, Tom, I'd go with the Middle Eastern potentate here, because he's got $200 million U.S., which all could be yours, I'm sure, for a small consideration. And this is a neat one. $4.5 million from your overdue total sum. They haven't paid you yet. And they're going to ship you an ATM card loaded with $4.5 million U.S. I'm not quite sure how that ATM card works in Canada. I don't think we have it. But just note, it's only $255 in shipping fees, and there are no hidden fees of any sort. So it must be legitimate. It's a wonderful offer. This guy's a bit more direct. He only wants a little bit of information. I think he's got tons of money, $15.5 million U.S. again, very worthwhile. But he has to set up a bank account. So, of course, he needs your passport and your ID and your date of birth and the name of your firstborn and all kinds of wonderful things. And Lawrence had indicated here earlier that DHL seemed to be a target for scammers. And here's one where your shipment is on the way, and all you have to do is click here to complete the delivery options. And I'm sure all they want is $75 in brokerage fees or something of the sort to get this package which you didn't order. And Francisco here, who actually lives in Poland, .pl is a Poland domain name, and he's optimistic when he sends scam emails to Canada, because he knows that we're bilingual, but he doesn't seem to realize that it's not Spanish. It's one of our second languages. So he's sending you a quote, and it's the quote you asked for, and he's available anytime. All you have to do is click on the PDF file and install the malware on your computer. But since we can't read Spanish, I'm sure nobody's going to do that. Well, only those people who read Spanish, I guess. Here's a very special offer from Costco. You've been selected for an exclusive award. Just answer this 30-second marketing survey about your shopping experience, and click OK to start, and who knows where we're going from there. I think this is where Chris would hover his mouse to see where the OK was.
Yeah, or right-click on it and say copy to clipboard and, investigate further.
Also, watch out for the links on the bottom to unsubscribe, because those are also tricky, or report
place.
Abuse.
Yeah. Takes you to the same place as clicking on OK.
or worse.
Yeah.
I like this one. This is a guy who's monitoring your webmail, and he's found security problems, and he's going to help you protect yourself.
Ionos is my they supply my website and my email.
Oh, and, but it's real.
Oh, well, no, it isn't.
Oh, but Ionos is real.
Ionos is real. Okay, so I usually get, three or four of these a week from different strange or origins, and I send them off. As you've probably seen in the emails that I forwarded to you, as well as to a bunch of other things, one of those is the Ionos people, so that they get it there. I don't know what they do about emails from other sources, but those that are pretending to be Ionos, I think they clamp down on very, very quickly. I've gotten a few replies from the Ionos support saying, thank you for sending us that email, and it was a fake, and we're taking care of it.
As opposed to Facebook, who are having trouble when you're logging on, and you just have to click here to sort it all out.
Yeah, that's a little.
Do you have a Facebook account, Tom?
Oh yeah, I do.
Wouldn't work with me because I don't use Facebook.
you can have things, but you will not get an email like this because Facebook, if you're having difficulties, you won't get an email saying, "Oh, you know, we care about you and we want to help you."
They don't care about you.
And they probably won't help you.
If this wasn't you, let us know.
So, telephone calls. I think we've all had telephone calls. This is an interesting one from Bob Harris, somebody pretending to be Service Canada, but using a robocall and indicating there's a problem with the social insurance number, and all you have to do is press 1 to speak to an agent. Well, now Service Canada don't do robocalls, and they wouldn't be asking you to press 1 to speak to an agent, and they certainly won't be phoning you about your social insurance number.
Wait, hang on. I heard, I think it's the CRA that has stated that they do use robocalls for contacting individuals.
Oh, but do they do this? They have an agent accent?
No, your point is taken. Someone made the previous point as to why would a firm do what they're doing. And unfortunately, there's many firms that will do stuff that it's like, oh my Lord, I mean, that is so suspicious. Why would you do that? How can I have any trust in you? And it's very innocent. I'm not talking like a Facebook type, 533 million, users out the door and going, oops, sorry. I mean, these are people that are trying to reach out, but they're not thinking it through as to how they're doing their messaging.
Yeah. So Bob Walker sent this in about the Canadian Revenue Service. They're going to take you to court and throw you in jail. He's been getting calls on his landline, on his cell phone, on his VoIP system. They're always spoofed numbers, usually spoofed Canadian phone numbers. But recently he's been noticing that some of the telephone numbers are local to Burritt Rapids, and some of his neighbor's phone numbers are showing up. And you can block them, but they just come back with a different number next time.
You know, they just copy in the area code and maybe the exchange to make you think that they're nearby.
Yeah,
I get lots of those, and they all often have a number that's very close to my own number.
Yeah.
One of the things is I've done a reverse number lookup on a lot of them, and a lot of them originate from the Kingston exchange, which is where my cell phone is based, and it comes up as a Bell Mobility number, but it doesn't give any specifics as to who, the name or the organization. It's the Bell Mobility number, blah. But Canada 411 does allow you to report it as a spammer or a robocaller and everything. And I assume that information goes back to Bell, but Bell doesn't really care because, you know, these people are customers and they make money off them. So they don't care if they're spamming you.
Well, no.
The other thing I can't understand is, you know, after 100 or so calls, why are they wasting their time with me?
Those numbers are usually faked. You can easily fake a return phone number using VoIP. So you may block a number and so on, and then it doesn't. Like on my Android phone, which is a Pixel 3, I can block the number so they can't. It'll be rejected by my phone in the future. But usually the numbers aren't real. I mean, they could be using anybody's number. I mean, they can fake numbers from Canada Revenue, from a 99 number in the Ottawa area. It's very easy for them to fake numbers. You can't depend on what the number is from at all. I mean, I get numbers from Florida, from all over the United States, but I also get lots of spam from 613.
Yeah, the phone companies actually have the technology to stop the spoofing, but they don't want to use it because, like I said before, these people are their customers and they make money off them. So they don't want to give them too hard a time.
Corrine's put a note here that CRA sent out a communique saying they contact people only by mail while using their internal messaging system. So they wouldn't be telephoning people, I guess. Which is pretty obvious when you get one of these particular calls.
I was contacted by CRA by phone, and I thought it was a scam, and it turned out it was legit after I hung up on them, but it was legitimate. They do call.
Well, come visit you in jail, Linda.
Yeah, I was in arrears.
Okay. How about SMS text messaging? Here's one from Netflix.com. We miss your bill. Oh, dear. But then again, if you look at it carefully, it's not really from Netflix.com. It's from login-netflix.com. And if you look up that URL, you'll find it was registered by cheap usernames or some cheapusernames.com in Iceland. So it's nothing to do with the Netflix.com domain, and it's clearly a scam. However, it's not always that easy. Here's one from Rogers. If you haven't been able to send email in Rogers the last few days, it's because they've closed their whole system down as of the 2nd of April, apparently. And if you didn't upgrade using this link to their new version, presumably you can't send mail anymore if you're a Rogers customer. But then again, it may not be legitimate, I guess. The problem is here, you can't, on a smartphone, I don't think you can hover over the link to see where it's sending you. Does anybody know how to decode links on smartphones?
That's a problem.
And while you're thinking about that, here's a similar one, but this one's from Canada Post. They tried to deliver a package to this individual, and now they need to verify their address. Maybe. Definitely not.
Oh, one funny thing about Rogers. When they originally started out, they gave out all their email addresses as soandso.rogers.com, and they gave them out, and you could have up to 5 email addresses. So I was the vice president.rogers.com for at least as long as I had a Rogers account. On to you,
and
Alan.
I think this is the final one. The final one I have is actually kind of interesting. And this is coming, this message, coming from a website called affirm.com. And it's basically saying, don't share a verification code, and your code is 5565. And then a minute later, you get exactly the same message with a different code. But this isn't asking you to click on anything. It's not telling you to do anything, really. If you look at affirm.com, it's actually a delayed payment type system. And they're giving it's like a two-factor authentication scheme where you need this code to process your payment. And it looks like what's happened is somebody's entered the wrong phone number, and so they sent the authorization code to the wrong number. The guy didn't get an authorization code, so he tried again, and he gave it the wrong number a second time. And that's the only thing I can think. I think this is just a misdirected text message.
It could be a genuine wrong number, but it could be somebody trying to do identity theft, and they set up an account with your phone number and name and everything at affirm.com, and now they're trying to send money from somewhere to somewhere, but they didn't manage to get your phone number redirected to them in time. I don't know. I mean, there are those possibilities.
Yeah, I don't know. It's obviously not going to work, though, because there's no way you can use this code. So.
No, but if they can redirect their phone number, if they can redirect your phone number to their phone, then they get the code. Then they can authorize the payment.
Okay.
Which could actually lead into the next slide.
Okay.
The next slide is about SIM swapping. So anybody who uses their phone SMS text messaging for two-factor authentication, so when you go to log on, they send you a text message with a code like the previous screen, and you have to enter that in. If you think that that's secure, it's not. There are better ways of doing things. It's better than nothing, but barely. You can read this, and I'm going to paste it into the chat window as well. So Krebs, a security blogger, just talks about how, I mean, we shouldn't be using this anymore. So a good read. And for me, I used to get a lot of, well, I probably still do get a lot of scam and spam phone calls, but I got really tired of answering them and listening to people and then hanging up on them. So if I don't recognize caller ID on my phone, I let it go to voicemail, and my outgoing voice message says, due to the high number of spam and scam emails, I don't answer the phone. If you're not a spammer, scammer, or charity trying to part me from my money, leave a message. If I believe you, I'll call you back. And no spammer or scammer has ever left a message. So I find that a quite effective way of dealing with scam phone calls.
Pixel also has a they will answer the phone for you. Your phone will answer and say, this is a call screener from Google and so on.
Yep.
And
yep.
I use that a lot when I don't recognize the phone number.
Yeah.
And
there's another screen coming up that I'll talk about an app that can do that. This is a Nomo Robo. And you can use it free on VoIP landlines. And if you want to use it on your mobile, it's $2 a month for use on mobile phones. And it has things like that where it can answer it. It can tell people, okay, you have to put in, you know, the following four digits for something to happen. They can record a message, and then you can get that later on. There's all kinds of flexibility in how it can actually handle this automatic answering of your phone and so forth. I haven't used this service. There are other ones like it as well. This is one of the lower cost items that I noticed out there. But if you're interested in that sort of thing, where to try to foil scammers and spammers, you could look into something like nomorobo.com. And this was an interesting article I came across in the New York Times. Who's making all those scam calls? And so they tracked down to Southeast Asia, where these call centers were actually doing the scams from. It's a pretty interesting read. So if you're interested in that, and I will paste that into the chat window as well. Okay, this is another thing that I came across, which recommendation that if you get a call on your phone, you don't recognize the number, don't call them back. One of the scams is that it goes back to a premium charge number. So they'll keep you on the phone for a little bit, and you'll be charged like $10 a minute or more for while you're on the phone. So don't ever think that calling back a number that you don't recognize is a smart thing. Probably not.
Yeah, the charges end up on your phone bill, and Bell and the other phone companies are basically acting as collection agencies for the scammers. And again, they make money off all this, so they have no incentive to stop the scamming.
Yeah.
If you have a pay-as-you-go account, then you don't get caught by these because they say you don't have enough money to own this number.
Yeah, but you might have enough money to pay for 1 minute or something like that.
Oh, I don't. Not currently. I only need to put money on if I'm going to go roaming.
So Bob's asking if there's any point in blocking numbers.
I don't think so, because they just change them all the time anyways. I don't know that I've ever gotten a scam phone call that came from a number that was the same number as before.
Natalie agrees with you, apparently.
Yeah. I think it's whack-a-mole. It's not worth it. It's
whack-a-mole hole, and they keep making holes.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
New holes all the time.
Well, the so-called do not call list is actually a phone book for these scammers.
Yeah.
Because they know it's an active phone number.
Yeah.
If I could speak to what Bob Walker said a little while ago about getting calls from a Bell Mobility number near Kingston somewhere. If I recall, there's a rather large penitentiary there, isn't there?
Couple.
I used to live down in southern Quebec, and there was a rather large medium security federal pen just down the road from me. And every 7-8 months, there were news reports of people trying to drone in cell phones.
Ah.
So there's a big market for people with nothing better to do than get their hands on burner phones.
And cause havoc.
So the idea of screening your calls, like Chris said, is obviously the best way to do it, because you never know where it's coming from. But there's a lot of people in prison with nothing better to do.
Yeah.
So okay, got any scams that we haven't covered today? Any recent ones?
I have a bridge if you're interested. No. That's it for me.
Okay, I think we've run well over. I just saw the last one here from John. Mentioned better option for two-factor authentication authorization rather than getting SMS codes. It depends on the website or whatever service it is that you're using. A lot of them are moving to authentication apps that are running on your phone as opposed to using SMS messaging. And that's a lot more secure because it is not tied to your phone number. It is tied to your phone. And that's the problem with SIM swapping, is that if somebody can manage to convince your cell phone provider that your SIM card is being transferred to somewhere else, then they have managed to get all of your text messages will then go to them. That doesn't work if you use an authentication app. And Google has one. Microsoft has one. There are a number of them out there. And if it's supported by the service that you use, it's much more secure than using text messaging.
Okay, so final couple of slides here. On Monday afternoon, 4:00, April the 12th, Chris has got a tech cafe for the library on how the internet works and sometimes doesn't. And then later in the week on Wednesday, it's our regular monthly meeting And our speaker is Linda Buskey, who is going to be telling us how to share photographs on the web.
And share photos, not necessarily on the web. That'll be the main thing, but other methods as well.
Okay. And the 14th will also be our next Q&A following Linda's presentation. So if you have questions or programs you want to share with your buddies, then send them along to the suggestion box. So thanks, everybody, for hanging in, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you all. Good night.